these seven last plagues we'll talk about are, as we know, the seven last plagues on Babylon, mystic Babylon. And I believe on page 165 of volume 3, we have a very timely quote from the pastor on this subject. He said, "These plagues are troubles foreshadowed in the troubles upon the rejected Jewish house are pictured in such lurid symbols in Revelation that many students have exaggerated, very exaggerated and wild ideas on this subject. And they are unprepared for the realities now closely impending." He said this in 1890. "Students often interpret the symbols literally and hence are unprepared to see them fulfilled as they will be," and we might interject, "as they are now being fulfilled by religious, social, and political disturbances, controversies, upheavals, reactions, revolutions, and so forth." The pastor said that in 1890. How much more appropriate is it today? And I'm not going to apologize for using one of the oldest reprints in the reprints, because I think they're as good at the beginning as they were at the end. Maybe some details might have to be changed, but I think this is a wonderful expression of things that will build up our confidence in the truth. We're going to use the pastor's review of the seven plagues in reprint 497 and 509. And I think this is a good basis for what we should have expected to happen to Babylon compared to what did happen. Now, the pastor, as we all know, was not dogmatic about any of these things. But we do believe that this presentation of the pastors will serve to make us think in an orderly manner about the fall and destruction of Babylon. And let's remember that chronologically we are 99 years into the millennium, so that if these scriptural plagues are going to happen, they must have already been in progress, even though they may not be completely fulfilled. When are they going to start if we're 99 years into the millennium? Let's begin with Revelation 15:2. "And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass." That's pretty mystical, isn't it? Who are these conquerors? "This is shown," the pastor said, "by what they overcame." They overcame the beast, the image, and the number. What is the beast referred to? We all know that this is papacy. We know that the image is organized sectarian Protestantism. We know that the mark is papacy's characteristics. And we know that the number is those who bear the characteristics of their number. Therefore, those who have conquered the beast and the image, who could they be? They've got to be the saints, this side of the veil, as well as those that have passed. Why? Because these are those over whom the beast and the image have no influence. What else does this text tell us? Doesn't it show us when the plagues are due? While Protestants began in earnest with Luther, it seems clear from our third volume studies, in the chapter on the cleansing of the sanctuary especially, that the image was formed by the organization of the Evangelical Alliance in 1846. If so, it's equally clear that the overcomers of the image, if they overcame the image, they could not have existed before 1846. Isn't that right? It's during the pouring out of the plague that the overcomers occupy this condition on the Sea of Glass. But we still need to know, what is this Sea of Glass mingled with fire on which they stand? We understand the sea to symbolize the irreligious masses of the people. And fire is understood to be judgments or trouble. Putting all this together, what do we have? We have the masses of the people in trouble under the judgments of God, don't we? And where are the overcomers shown in this picture? They're shown standing above the troubled people, and they're calm and serene and untroubled. Their position shows they're standing on the sea of glass is by faith. To the eye of faith, all is transparent as glass. And certainly, the trouble the people are in is clear to us. It's even clear to them. We drop now to the fifth verse, and after that, I'm quoting, after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened, the ecclesiastical heaven. And the sixth verse, and the seven angels came out of the temple, having the seven plagues, clothed in pure white linen, and having their breasts girded with golden girdles. Here John saw the coming of the seven messengers out of the temple to pour out the plagues. Now let's not confuse this with the seven angels to the church, or the seven messengers to the church. Seven means complete. Since it is the saints who are to execute the judgments written in Psalms 149:9, we interpret these seven angels to mean those standing on the sea of glass, the living saints as representatives or active agents of the entire anointed company, the feet of him. It's the feet of him, or the last part, who sing the restitution song of Moses and the Lamb above the sea mingled with fire. The same feet as representatives on earth of the entire body are to pour out the seven plagues, or to be associated more or less directly with the judgments coming. These are clothed with white linen. These have kept their wedding garments. These are robed in the righteousness of Christ and justified by his blood. These are the servants of God and have a divine service to accomplish. Who is that? It's the church still on this side of the veil. So it's important that we know a little bit about these plagues. After all, if we're going to be pouring them out, or if we have been pouring them out, we ought to know our part in this role, shouldn't we? I'm not saying we don't, but I'm impressed with the fact that all around us, the signs are showing us that this is happening. The messengers are now nearly all out of the temple, and already the smoke or the confusion in the church is considerable. Revelation 16:1 says, "And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, Go your ways and pour out your vials of the wrath of God on the earth." The nominal systems, we know, are anxious to retain every member, for everyone counts. And their boast is in numbers and wealth. But when they find anyone who counts all earthly considerations but loss and dross, and who will not be fettered by man-made creeds, they thrust such out, saying, "Go then, do your worst, go your way." So let's see now how these seven plagues form an outline or a prophecy of the events surrounding the fall of Babylon between 1878 and 1973. Or, let's say, after 1846. Remember, brethren, that, again, we're already in the 99th year of the millennium, and remember that these plagues are scriptural. And if they're scriptural, they must be fulfilled. And remember also that they cannot be any earlier than 1846, according to this reasoning, and that they cannot be poured out after the church is glorified if it's the saints this side of the veil that are doing the pouring. So we must conclude that the plagues are somewhere between having been poured out and the process of completion. I'm not setting any dates, but there is considerable logic in this reasoning of the pastors. And I think it's good that as we talk about this, that all of us consider what's happening and when did it happen. I think it'll help all of us to understand where we are in the stream of time. In the Diaglot, Revelation 16:2 reads, "And the first angel went forth and poured out his bowl on the land, and there came an evil and malignant ulcer on those men having the mark of the beast and on those worshipping his image." What is the land on which this bowl was poured? It's a symbol of settled, organized society under religious restraint. What's the mark of the beast? We've already said that's the characteristics of the papacy. Who are those worshiping the image of the beast? They're Protestants. There was a time when Protestants used to protest. That's how they got their name, remember? But now it seems they worship the image of the beast. If they are serious in their ecumenical councils, and brethren, they've been having ecumenical councils. You recall in the fourth volume how the pastor in the Ecclesiastical Confusion chapter talks about the Parliament of Religions, and in from 1910 to 19. Approximately 62, they have been holding at least 30 ecumenical councils, all of which led up to the formation of the World Council of Churches. All during this time, they were trying to get the papacy to join them. And the papacy all during this time was holding meetings about prayers for the returned brethren and having some way of communicating with these brethren so they could get them back into the Catholic Church. And just before they formed, the Protestants formed the World Council of Churches, the Catholics had observers at one of the councils. After the World Council was formed, the Protestants and the Vatican Secretariat formed a committee for ecumenism so they could talk to each other. This happened about the time that Pope John held the Vatican Council II. So then, on whom was this first plague poured? It was poured on those having the characteristics of papacy and worshiping Protestantism. Do Roman Catholics belong to this land class? Yes. Does this bowl of wrath get poured on them too? No. We can see that the ulcer is not on those worshiping the beast, but on those having the mark of the beast. Not on those worshiping the beast, that would be a Catholic, but those having the mark of the beast. Why is their trouble compared to an evil and malignant ulcer? To appreciate this symbol, let's consider the literal. What is an ulcer? It's a running sore. And of what is a running sore an evidence? It's an evidence of a constitutional disorder, isn't it? And does it hurt? It's supposed to be very painful. And what's a malignant ulcer? It's a cancer in its worst stages. And what effect does this cancerous sore have? It eats and corrupts and destroys. Now, let's carry the thought. What an ulcer or a bad cancer is to a man illustrates the character of the consuming, life-draining trouble coming upon the Babylonish systems today, which trouble will ultimately destroy Protestantism. And from where is this trouble arising? From within Protestantism. These 25 or so ecumenical councils they had took three different roads where they were all going separate directions. Some of them said they would do it by missions. Some of them said they'd do it by getting everybody together and so on. They finally decided that they'd have to band together. So, why would they want to get together if everything was okay? There had to be something wrong inside. The constitutional disorder is caused by errors inherited and retained from the mother of harlots and abominations, such things as the Trinity, or immortality, hell, and so on. Has this cancer or this ulcer been visible since 1878? Not necessarily. They carefully try to conceal it, don't they? But we know it's there because of the bad odor and the distress that's noticeable. What's the cure? There is no cure because their blood is poisoned. It's permeated the entire body and death is inevitable. Was there ever a time when the daughters might have been healed? Oh, yes. During Luther's time and the Reformation, but Jeremiah 8:11 tells why her false ministers healed the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. What hurt's referred to here? It's the sore, the ulcer. And there's no peace because her whole system is diseased and needs thorough cleansing with the medicine of God's Word. But will they take this medicine, God's Word? No, they're looking around for a doctor who will let them take some other kind of medicine to heal the sore. Many human remedies are being proposed, but we know they won't work. They're looking for the famous balm of Gilead that Jeremiah in 46:11 tells them to take. He said, go up into Gilead and take balm, O virgin, the daughter of Egypt. In vain shalt thou use many medicines. for thou shalt not be cured. And in Jeremiah 8:22, we're told why they can't find the healing balm. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? Because there was a balm in Gilead, and a physician that could have healed them, but they preferred to use their own doctor. Revelation 18:23 says, "And the light of a candle shall shine no more in her, and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee." And Revelation 3:16 says, "I know thy works, that thou art neither hot nor cold. I would that thou wert cold or hot." So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I'll spew thee out of my mouth. What then do we conclude? Now there is no balm in Gilead, there is no physician there, therefore she is not helped, her king is not in her, she's spewed out of his mouth. True to the scripture, there is no cure for the malignant ulcer. The pastor wrote in reprint 255, page 4, way back then, and how true his statements are today. Those who are looking for a union in Christendom in which denominational names and denominational lines will be obliterated are looking for what they will never see until the great collapse comes. And the entire Christendom system, social, religious, political, and financial, goes down in the great anarchist trouble with which the gospel age will end. The union which will be cemented, the one that they're getting together on, will be largely one of common sentiment and cooperation in moral and political reforms. So, this first plague is poured out on the Protestants, resulting in a constitutional disorder which they are frantically trying to cure, but they won't take the right medicine. While this first plague was having its effect on the land class, organized religions except Catholicism, we read that the second angel poured out his bowl into the sea, and it became blood, as one of dead, and every living soul died in the sea. Now, what does this mean? What's the sea? What's the blood of the dead? Who died in the sea? We know that the sea symbolizes irreligious masses of mankind, those not under religious restraint. And how can we appreciate the plague on this class? We must study the symbol, which is blood. Blood in a living creature is vitality, the principle of life or animation. In a dead person, it's the reverse. No vitality, no animation. No life. After death, we know that blood rapidly separates into two parts, watery liquid called serum and more solid substance called clot. The clot, immediately after death, begins to putrefy and corrupt. We understand this symbol to teach that the sea class becomes like the blood of a dead person. This sea class will go through a great and thorough disintegration, after which one element of these irreligious masses of mankind, not under religious restraint, will rapidly corrupt and putrefy. And we know there have been many noble specimens of humanity who have commingled with these irreligious masses, imparting life and vitality to this group. Persons like Clarence Darrow, Thomas Huxley, Voltaire, they didn't believe in the Bible. In our time, many of us have known some fine free thinkers among our friends who were either atheists or agnostics. How does this relate to the second plague? A separation of these types of nobler elements of society is due. And when this happens, what will result? Decay and death to every principle of morality and virtue in the C class. What's left? When every living thing, every element of virtue and benevolence among them will perish. Are we seeing anything like that today? Just look at the entertainment sections of any newspaper or magazine. Is there any morality there? What happens when you remove the element which advises prudence, morality, and right doing from the counsels of the restless masses? It's quick destruction of life, property, laws, peace, a grand reign of anarchy. And the Watts riots have been a pretty good example, I think, of how that is beginning. Have we seen any of these signs on campuses? What about the kind of music we hear today? What about the books that are written today? And the forms of art? And what about the various associations which protest against anything and everything? Are these signs of the corruption of these irreligious masses? Daniel 12:1 says we can expect trouble such as never was, and the wicked shall do wickedly. We see the separation of the serum from the clock, the separation of the vitality element from the corrupting element. It's in progress all around us. And in 1883, when the pastor wrote much of this, he said, this plague is still future, but it has had more than a beginning. I wonder what he'd say today. We can see it plainly in our day. With this second plague over, stirring up the already discontented masses, it prepares the way for anarchy. And we know that these plagues go into action one at a time, but while one starts, the others keep going until you have them all going like a symphony. With both the first and second plagues poured out, we go to the third one. The third angel poured out his bowl into the rivers and into the fountains of waters, and they also became blood. And I heard an angel of the water saying, righteous art thou, the one who is and was, the bountiful one, because thou hast judged these. Because they poured out the blood of the saints and the prophets, thou gavest them also blood to drink. They deserve it. What are these rivers and fountains which became blood? We know that running water symbolizes truth. Rivers are waters through which truth has flowed and symbolize various sects or denominations, and the fountains symbolize the founders and schools of these various systems, the places or men in whom these channels of truth had their beginning, theological seminaries and so on. Yes, water did flow in these systems for a long time, especially in the Protestant systems. Luther, Wycliffe, Calvin. Even though the water was truly muddy in some, many partook and became refreshed. But what happened, and what's happening today? A change has come. What once refreshed gradually became loathsome as blood. How might this plague be understood then? Might it be a picture of a change rapidly taking place in religious channels, their creeds, though containing as much error and truth as ever, they're beginning to regard differently now? In the literal plague on Egypt, what did the people do when they could no longer drink of the bloody waters? They dug wells. So, in these years from 1974 to now, independent thinkers are digging other channels for themselves, for purer waters, than the regular channels will afford. And this is corroborated by the great upsurge of new denominations. In the last less than 100 years, religious denominations that never existed before had become more numerous than the regular ones. What was once received without question is now becoming loathsome and death-like because general enlightenment is greater. Daniel prophesied that knowledge shall be increased. Has knowledge been increased? We're all familiar with those charts of inventions. You look at any annual almanac published by the newspapers in the section on inventions, you'll find nothing, relatively nothing, until 1700s. And then in the 1800s, it gets darker, and in the 1900s, proliferation of inventions, coming thick and fast so we cannot even comprehend. Before we use one, four others are already there. What's on the drawing board is already obsolete when they put it into production. Is it clear then how they get blood to drink? By retaining Satan's big lie and rejecting the Lord's testimony, many have come and others are coming to a realization of the blood as too obnoxious and nauseating to be palatable to either themselves or the world. So this third plague affects the sources of false teachings and enables some to recognize that they are false. The first three plagues already poured out are operating simultaneously when the fourth angel pours out his bowl on the sun, and to him it was given to burn men with fire. And men were burned with great heat, and they blasphemed the name of that God who has authority over these plagues, and they reformed not to give him glory. How is the misery of this plague caused? It's caused by sunlight, symbolizing gospel light. Looking back, we can see that the six volumes of scripture studies and their tabernacle shadows gave gospel light. And when they were digging these wells for fresh water, there it was. Those who worshipped and honored their sect and the creeds of the Dark Ages more than they worshipped God were scorched and annoyed with the great light and heat of the truth of this gospel light. And how did it come out? It reached them in writings, preachings, photodrama, and the witnessing of the seventh messenger and his brethren. All classes were affected by this increased light. This plague is not limited, as we can see, to a certain class like the other ones were, the sand, the sea, the land, and the rivers. This one is to mankind in general and on representative leaders of men in particular. Everything that is hid shall be revealed. This great light shows up everything, and even at the time of this convention, we see how the searching rays of this light have brought out the truth in the Watergate case as a plague upon representative leaders of men from a political standpoint. There was a time when this could have been scotched immediately, not any longer. But the effect of greater light upon the greater masses of people has been nothing short of fantastic. It has caused independence of thought and action among all classes of society. I think the most interesting thing about these statements by the pastor is that they sound like they're happening right now, and he saw them then. In its effect upon the fall and destruction of Babylon, what is this increased light causing? It's causing differences between rulers and those being ruled, and it's caused differences between kings and subjects before 1914, and it's caused differences between capital and labor. Did you ever stop to think that the AFL was formed in 1881? And since then, history relates the conflict between labor and management until this day. Prior to that time, there was no industrial organization to amount to anything. Another difference that has happened exists between lay preachers and clergy. Protestants now have lay readers, and the Catholics, I understand, have laymen offering the Mass. The increasing light emboldens the layman to take part in church services. We see the truth spreading on every subject. Truth relative to the right and authority of kings. Truth relative to the rights of both labor and capital. Truth relative to the superiority and lordship of a self-appointed clergy. And truth causes those in Babylon to blaspheme by becoming angry with the truths that prove the love and mercy of God and His justice. So they go to the very extreme of opposition, and they grossly misstate God's character and often wrest His word to sustain their theories of hell, Trinity, and so forth. This scorching heat of gospel light is a plague to those in Babylon. So this fourth plague causes a difference between the rulers and the ruled, and it disturbs papacy. The fifth angel then poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and his kingdom was darkened. And they bit their tongues because of the pain, and blasphemed the God of heaven on account of their pain. We recall that the first plague was poured on those worshiping the image of the beast, Protestantism. This fifth plague comes upon papacy, its rulers, those in authority, the throne, the power, the clergy. The kingdom of the ruling class is filled with darkness and uncertainty because of the absence of their former power to create unity and harmony. Someone at the table told me today about a newspaper article where the bishops have been prohibited from saying anything that's contrary to what the Pope says. But what good does it do? They're going to say whatever they want. So the ruling class doesn't know what to do. Not only has she and her daughters been spewed out of his mouth in 1878, but her trouble grows and the pain will be increased by tongue biting. What are the tongues of papacy? It's decrees, utterances, past and future. Biting would imply contradiction and denial of former utterances. And we've all read how they're trying to figure out how to explain the infallibility of the Pope. There's articles in the paper all the time explaining, well, we don't mean that the Pope is infallible in everything, but there's certain things he's infallible in. Well, that's biting your tongue, isn't it? In 1883, the pastor says, now this is very significant. In 1883, he said, whether this signifies a contradiction and reversal of previous utterances of the papal hierarchy, or whether it means controversy and differences between the living rulers of the church, we may not decide, but it will probably include both these difficulties. Since then, what have we seen regarding contradiction and reversal of previous utterances? The 1973 official Associated Press Almanac says, regarding the revised calendar of saints, quote, two of the best known saints in the Roman Catholic Church, Saint Valentine, the patron of sweethearts, and Saint Christopher, the patron of travelers, were dropped from the official liturgical calendar in 1969 in a sweeping change that removed more than 200 from the list of saints whose feast days are celebrated by the whole church. Do you think they'd do that if they weren't in trouble? The anniversary celebrations of 92 other saints, including St. George of England and St. Nicholas, who has been celebrated as Santa Claus, were made optional. In June 1963, Pope Paul VI, the present Pope, discontinued the Index of Forbidden Books, and he abolished the office of Inquisitor. He was the first Pope to confer with a head of the Anglican Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury. How low can you get after having been on the pinnacle? In his comments on the Second Vatican Council of 1962, which was the first the Catholics had in almost a century, Robert McAfee Brown wrote a book called The Ecumenical Revolution. And he said, regarding the role of Mary, quote, "Next to papacy, Mariology is the area of greatest theological division between Catholics and Protestants. The problem centers on the two most recent papal pronouncements, one, the dogma of the Immaculate Conception of Mary, so that she was freed from the taint of original sin, and the second is the dogma of the assumption of the Virgin into heaven immediately after her death. Among many pre-Vatican II Protestant difficulties with these dogmatic affirmations, three were prominent. One, there was a concern that the increasing attention focused on Mary in Catholic thought was in danger of eclipsing the centrality for faith and devotion that should be focused on her son. Two, they feared that this particular strand of doctrinal development was proceeding unchecked, so that it would issue in a papal definition of Mary as co-redeemer." Isn't that awful? "A doctrine that would seem to Protestants fatally to undermine the New Testament's stress on her son as the sole mediator between man and God." How did papacy bite her tongue on that utterance of Mariology? The ecumenical chapter on Mary was finally written so that the saving action of Mary's son Jesus would not need to be jeopardized. That speeches on the council floor by South American bishops pointed out that Marian piety was indeed exaggerated and that the chapter was couched in as biblical a framework as possible, replacing the string of papal quotations that had characterized in the earlier draft. Why did they do this? So that there might be an ecumenical meeting point with Protestants and Orthodox, both of whom affirm the authority of biblical statements, but not of papal statements. Would we say this biting is occasioned by the pain and humbled condition in which papacy finds herself? Has she any temporal power? When we remember it was this same papal system which had in its prosperity a mouth speaking great things, Daniel 7, 8:25 and Revelation 13:5, should it surprise us that God should ordain as part of its reward that it should eat its own words? So this fifth plague came on the papacy itself to question and find some way of disclosing things which at one time were considered, disclaiming things which at one time were considered settled issues. The sixth plague, literal Babylon. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river, the Euphrates, and its waters were dried up, so that the way of those kings who are from the sun rising might be prepared. Literal Babylon was built on the river Euphrates, from which Babylon's wealth, supplies, and substance came. Babylon was protected by immense walls and strong gates over the river. Who was within the city in bondage? Israelites, who were God's covenanted people. And God appointed Cyrus, the Median general, to deliver these Israelites. Think back now. Did Cyrus, coming to this strong city to attack it, did he do it directly? No, he dug another channel for the waters of the river drying up the old channel and permitting him to march his army under the gates and capture the city. Babylon generally describes the entire nominal church. Specifically, it describes that portion of the nominal church called the Mother of Harlots. The sixth plague is upon Babylon, the mother. It's interesting to note that in the third plague, the bowl was poured out on the rivers, plural. So while the other systems have channels and rivers, the mother system is built upon the great river. Revelation 17:5 identifies the mother, saying, "In her forehead was the name written, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth." And following the literal and applying the symbol, who would we reason that the waters of this great Euphrates represent? We all know it's the people who support papacy by their influence and money, from which Babylon the Great draws her revenues. Proof, Revelation 17:15. The waters which thou saw where the harlot sitteth, where the harlot sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. The statistics in the 1971 Britannica Book of the Year show that there are 925 million Christians in the world, and of these, 580 million are Roman Catholics. 125 million are Eastern Orthodox and 218 million are Protestants. That makes 62% Catholic, 14% Orthodox, and 24% Protestant. Now, the reason for pointing out the greatness of Babylon in numbers is that the greatest numbers are deserting. The river Euphrates is drying up. And when that's gone, there'll be nothing to hold the system together. And the pastor said that if we apply the symbol of the waters of the Euphrates, the great river drying up, what would we expect to happen? A disaffection would spring up between the subject and the church authorities. What's happened along this line? The laymen have started to ask for a part in the church service and have received the right to offer the Mass. The subjects are disenchanted because the church will not permit birth control, nor divorces, and many leave for that reason. The changes in the church doctrine, such as Mariology, saying the Mass in local languages, the statements of church infallibility, the priests running away and getting married, the dropping of the saints, the dropping of the forbidden books list, have caused doubts to spring up in the minds of the subjects. Sects like Jehovah's Witnesses and others who study the Bible are a plague upon the system which for so many years not only banned Bible study, but they forgot to study it themselves because they depended so much on the sacred sacraments, so now they can't even answer the question. Most of this sixth plague has already been fulfilled. And its fulfillment, according to the sources quoted, are common knowledge. What remains before she and the daughters are cast into the sea like a great millstone is part of what will happen to Babylon in the future, which we're not going to go into here. That would be a subject entirely separate. Besides, it's and unknown, we could do a lot of guessing. We believe that these six plagues, the first on the land, second on the sea, third on the rivers and fountains, fourth on the sun, fifth on the throne of the beast, and sixth on the Euphrates, are all working simultaneously at present to bring about the complete destruction of Babylon. And certainly the signs of the times corroborate what has happened in each plague. If Brother Russell's interpretation of the symbol is correct, we must admit, brethren, that it was uncannily accurate in many respects. The only question mark we have time-wise is the seventh plague, which is poured out upon the air, and there came a loud voice from the temple of God saying, "It is done." We believe it's possible that this plague has been poured out, but we do not believe this plague has been completed nor got much past its beginning. The pastor equates this destruction of Babylon and the pouring out of the seventh plague as with the binding of Satan. That's Satan's masterpiece, and when that's destroyed, he will be completely bound. We will ask you to read the account of the seventh plague, reprint 509, and decide for yourself regarding the status of this plague. However, Brother Russell's interpretation of it as done indicates that to some extent, both the daughters and the mother are beginning to see the truth about many of their doctrines being false and getting ready to say to those who left Babylon that it is done. That those who left had warned Babylon correctly that their doctrines were false. We believe a fitting close would be to read the pastor's comments in the question book on the subject of the binding of Satan. If we use this analysis of the pastors of the seven last plagues, which we, the brethren on this side of the veil, are pouring out, I believe it will help us to think about the fall and destruction of Babylon in an orderly manner. May the Lord have his blessing.